One commentator argued that the referendum provided a good lesson on how independence campaigns can still be inclusive. In this case, in the case of the Scottish referendum, British citizens who are resident in Scotland were entitled to vote in the referendum. Resident citizens of the 52 other Commonwealth countries were also entitled to vote, along with, of course, EU citizens resident of the other 27 European Union countries. Now, looking ahead, another important question is whether we are moving towards the gradual but inevitable disintegration of the United Kingdom. And this is a question which is particularly relevant in light of the vows and recent recommendations that have been made on the devolution of more powers to the Scottish Parliament. Will the devolution of more power to Scotland calm the appetite for independence? Or is it likely to make independence an inevitability? And so, will there be another referendum on Scottish independence in the future? Now, Jerry has been invited to discuss the various questions that have arisen in light of the Scottish referendum. We had the pleasure of having Jerry over last June for a panel discussion on a possible independent Scotland. And he looked at the economic and social implications of Scottish independence. I have the pleasure tonight of introducing to you today Jerry. He's a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Open University and a member of the International Centre for Comparative Criminological Research. His research interests include the theories of neoliberalism and their relation to social policy as well as Scottish devolution. He was previously a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Paisley and has previously also taught sociology at the University of Aberdeen-Dundee and the University of Glasgow and Stirling University. He's been lecturing at the Centre for British Studies for quite some time, and he's also a fellow at the Centre. His most recent research projects focus, among others, on the political, economic geography of Scottish devolution and different dimensions of class divisions and class inequalities in contemporary Scotland. He's also analysing the role of criminal justice policymaking in nation building, particularly in the context of devolution, federalism, and will be co-editing a work entitled Crime, Justice and Society in Scotland. So, Jerry, without further ado, after the Scottish independence referendum, what now for the future of the UK?
Thank you, Ali. Well, hello everyone, it's great to be here again. Nice to see lots of faces of people I know, even if one or two of them are faces I'm going to give a hard time to later on, because we're on different sides in the Scottish independence referendum. When you say that I've been at the centre for a long time, I first came over in 2000. That seems a long time ago. But if you'd said to me here in 2000, when I was first here, that I would in 14 years' time be delivering a lecture on the Scottish independence referendum, I'd have thought you were crazy. The idea of an independence referendum, so far-fetched, was never going to happen. And here we are now, 14 years later, looking back on Scotland's first, but as I'm going to argue, not only independence referendum. So I appreciate the invitation to be here. I always love coming here to Berlin, and I hope we're going to get a good discussion, debate, and even more importantly, a good argument later on. Now, as ever, when I come here, I apologise for my accent, although apparently I do have an accent, yeah. When I was in the United States recently talking on these issues, somebody in Kentucky, at one of the universities I was speaking in Kentucky, said to me, well, I love your accent. I said, thank you very much, you know. And where are you from? I said, where do you think I'm from? And they hummed and hawed and went, Europe? I went, yes, yes. Yeah, I thought, that's fine, that's good, that's good. Now let me think. So whereabouts in Europe? Germany? So nine was my response there. No? So I said Scotland. Scotland, Germany, it's all the same. Yeah. Anyway, it's lovely to be here. If you look at the slide here, lots of wee images on there. Aye, no, yes in Glasgow, UK okay, vote yes. So these are the different camps. An independence referendum, the yes campaign for independence, the no campaign, obviously arguing for Scotland to stay within the UK. Now, I've got probably far too many slides. And the reason for that is that things are changing almost on a daily basis. Yeah, now, you say that sometimes it sounds exaggerated. It's absolutely not exaggerated. I go and look at the email from home, or I go and look at something that's come in through Twitter or on the web or what have you. I think, oh, bloody hell, I need to go and rewrite this. Because things are rapidly changing. I mean, Ali referred to the devolution of more powers. That's the big issue because the report only came out last Thursday. And the fallout from that is now beginning to happen today, as of right this minute, not just today in the sort of modern period. So there's a lot of issues that I can't touch upon, and partly because of time, and they may come up in the discussion. But I want to try and speak for maybe an hour maximum and go through lots of these slides. You'll be pleased it's not all dense text. It's lots of nice images, yeah? So you can see bits of my world and see what was replicated in the independence referendum there. I want to start with this image. Yeah? This is, for those of you who have been there, the centre of Glasgow. This is George Square. The building in the background is the headquarters of Glasgow City Council. This is the City Chambers. And I want you to hold on to that image as much as you can and look at the date. September the 17th, 2014. So it's the evening before the independence referendum. So that image is important. We'll come back to that image later on. But there you are, the evening before the independence referendum. How do we capture where that referendum has left us? Here is The Economist. Quote from The Economist, September the 27th. Nobody asked to design a political system for Britain would ever propose the one it has. The one in the large islands and many smaller ones that The Economist calls home are a hodgepodge of parliamentary systems, unevenly distributed powers and constitutional uncertainties. The setup is as uneven as Britain's history is eventful, which is no coincidence. The causes of the mess, date back centuries. The latest upheaval, Scotland's referendum on independence, has made things untidier still. Now, this referendum was heralded as securing once and for all Scotland as an independent country, or Scotland's future within the UK. And I know people personally who voted no because they were worried about the future. They thought the future would be more uncertain. Well, to be honest with you, looking back now, the argument could be made that a yes vote would have given you a much more clearer, certain future. Whereas at the moment, it does look somewhat messy for reasons I'm going to go into. So the Scottish independence referendum, as I say there, has dramatically transformed the debate about the future of the UK. We don't have a written constitution in the UK, as they have, for example, in America, but it's transformed that debate. It's really called into question. So what I want to look on, there's a whole number of different things. There's many other things I haven't got time to look at, as I said. So the background, I want to look at the demand for Scottish independence. What was it really about? Because there's a whole lot of myths around this, yeah? What were the key arguments made by the Yes campaign? I want to look at the key aspects of the referendum result itself, because I think those are quite important. What issues won it for the No camp? Yeah. We are now for the Yes campaign. We are now for Scotland and the UK. And finally, the question Ali also posed, is the breakup of the United Kingdom and Scottish independence inevitable? Now, I'll give you my conclusion now and you can go away and think about it if you want. I think Scottish independence is now inevitable. I would not have said that before the independence referendum. So, there's a change within a couple of months or so, what has happened. So let me tease this out. So, let's start. I'll go through some of these quite quickly because I'm assuming that many of you will know this. But, yeah, we have this image of this place called the UK. This one unified entity. And of course that's the image that the United Kingdom projects around the world. Yes, it will say there are different heritages, different stories within the islands of the British Isles, but we have this United Kingdom, this one country. Well, of course, Ali referred back to 1707, and we see at different points in history, this union of the different countries within the United Kingdom took place. And that union has been an evolving and developing thing. It's not just a static thing going back to 1707 or with the context of Ireland back in 1921 with the North of Ireland being formed as a separate entity. Yeah. So the UK has evolved historically. But we shouldn't forget in that evolution the existence of pre-UK national identities still exist. So the majority of people in Scotland do not think of themselves as British first and foremost, they think of themselves as Scottish. The majority of people in Wales, similarly, Ireland will leave out for most of a different context. In England, since the UK was established, and particularly over the last couple of hundred years, the majority of people probably saw themselves as being British. But that's beginning to change now. There's a bigger emphasis on what it is to be English in the UK today. So the UK is an evolving, changing union. But within that union, these long-standing national differences are arguably coming to the fore a wee bit more. And we forget, people talk about Scottish independence as if it's an odd thing. Scotland has been an independent country for far longer than it's been part of the United Kingdom. So history matters here. History matters incredibly. Yeah? Here is the UK. Go show my new technical skills. Here is England, or Mordor, as we call it at times. Yeah. Here's Wales. Northern Ireland, much more problematically. And here we have civilization. Yeah? Home. Yeah? Now, these historic legacies are hugely important. We forget that being a member of the UK is a sort of voluntary thing, perhaps. I'll leave Northern Ireland out of this for a minute. But, you know, Scotland opted in to the UK. Now, when I say Scotland opted in 1707, of course, there's probably more people in this room than there were people who agreed to Scotland becoming part of the UK or forming the UK in 1707. But it's a voluntary thing. So if the majority of people in Scotland said, do you want to be a part of the UK? The majority of people in England said, likewise then, there were huge issues around that. Very different from the situation in Spain. And a lot of people have drawn parallels between Catalonia and the Basque Country and what's happening in Spain. I'm not sure they're exactly the same parallels. I think Basque Country a bit more settled than Catalonia. But yeah, there the indissoluble unity of the Spanish nation comes first and foremost. Nobody talks about that in the terms of the British nation, because a lot of people will be struggling to know what is the British nation, what are the components of that. So there's a big issue here about Britishness anyway. So let's look at the referendum outcomes. Yeah. Now, some of this, again, I'd imagine will be familiar to many of you. Turnout of 85%, incredible turnout, fantastic turnout. The biggest turnout in any UK voting event since 1918, I'm told, because I wasn't there. 650,000 voters didn't vote, though. But nonetheless, 85% is a huge turnout. In several areas, 90% plus. And these tended to be very affluent areas, all of which voted no, I might add. Glasgow, my own city, recorded a 75% turnout. Now, people think, well, 25%, a quarter still didn't turn out. But for Glasgow, that is incredibly high, because it has had a huge problem for the last 30, 40 years with low electoral turnouts at every election. Yeah. 1.6 million people voted for Scottish independence. 45% of the population who voted. Now, if you'd said to me 5 years ago, never mind back in 2000, 1.6 million people in Scotland, 45% of the population are going to vote for independence, I'd have thought you were mad. It's gone from being such a marginal issue to becoming a core part of contemporary Scotland. So few would have predicted that. And part of that is the reason that many voters aged 40 and over, and I just slightly creep into that category by a few years, perhaps more, yeah, grew up in an era when the Scottish National Party, these were nutters. These were your brave heart nationalists. You know, what about Claymores and, you know, the English, this, that. Well, come on, they're just head cases, yeah? But that has gone from being a marginal issue to becoming a core part of the contemporary political scene in Scotland. So the Yes campaign, however you want to measure it, obviously it failed in its ultimate goal for now, There was a hugely successful campaign. 1.6 million people, 45% voting yes. And I would argue that it was only prevented, only stopped by the intervention, hasty intervention, by the UK Unionist Party leaders, the media, and so on, and I'll come back to that. So, there's the context. There is the context. Background, well, what has happened since? Yeah. What led to this independence referendum? What drove it? Yeah. You'll see there that there was a widespread unpopularity of the UK government. The UK has a very polarised political landscape. The vast majority of people in Scotland did not vote for either of the UK coalition government partners, the Conservatives or the Liberal Democrats. They either voted Labour or for the SNP. So it looks like we have an alien government, UK government, that we did not vote for. Yeah? There's huge unpopularity of that government, the idea that the policies that it's introducing, welfare reform, austerity measures, not going down well. Not going down well in parts of England or Wales and Northern Ireland, but in Scotland it has a political edge to it because of the role of the SNP, which I'll come back to. Growing unhappiness with the Labour Party, who appear to be ineffective and challenging some of these policies, indeed in some respects I actually agree with some of the policies from the UK coalition. Demands in Scotland for more devolution, what's getting called now devo-max or devo-max. I'll come back to that. Yeah. Growth of the SNP, growing separation between Scotland and other parts of the UK, increasingly feels different. Yeah. In terms of a whole range of social policy, public policy areas, Scotland is following a different line from that of England or from Wales or Northern Ireland, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of divergences taking place. Yeah. So the political landscape of the UK is already very different depending on which part of the UK you actually live in. Yeah? Now, what about this demand then for independence? What are the myths and realities here? Here is Will Hutton, well-known political and social commentator, in the UK, speaking to the Observer a couple of weeks before the independence referendum. He says, if Britain can't find a way of sticking together, it is the death of the liberal enlightenment before the atavistic forces of nationalism and ethnicity. A dark omen for the 21st century. Britain will cease as an idea. We will all be diminished. Here we have the Financial Times, again, just a week or so before the independence referendum. The SNP has reawakened the allegiance of the tribe. Surprised they didn't use clan there instead of tribe, that they're giving a Scottish slant. Here we have John McTiernan at the bottom, the day after the referendum, speaking in the Daily Mail, dreadful newspaper that it is. Populism is sweeping Europe and the UK is not immune. The SNP surge is part of this phenomenon. The characteristics are putting the nation and its needs and aspirations above all other calls on solidarity. So here we have this image of an ethnic nationalist movement, a liberation movement, conjuring up all these nasty ethnic and nationalistic forces that want to overthrow this enlightened UK. Is that what it was about? Is that really what it was about? This has come into debate in other ways in the UK. Here is Jonathan Friedland speaking in the Guardian just two weeks ago. Look at the quote here on the right from this article. Just looking at the two surging movements in the UK politics, the SNP and UK independence, the latter now buoyed by winning its second MP in Rochester. The SNP insists that it represents a kinder, gentler, more civic nationalism than UKIP, the UK Independence Party. But both mine national solidarity and the rising sense that a hated and distant capital, Westminster, in one case, Brussels in the other, is thwarting the people's true destiny. So there's a parallel drawn immediately here between the SNP on the one hand and UKIP on the other. Here's a cartoon from the Observer, again only beginning of last month. Here you have Riddle, famous cartoonist in The Guardian and Observer. And the thing to note here, this is something we always pick up in Scotland all the time. If an English newspaper, though the Guardian see itself as a UK paper, if an English newspaper wants to capture Scotland and the SNP, well, you've got to put a kilt on it. Because obviously, include myself here right a minute, everybody in Scotland wears a kilt, so you need to put a kilt on it, you know. How could you represent Scotland otherwise? And here we have the clown, the funny clown of the UKIP. But those of you who know anything about UKIP or read their policies would find that there's not that much that's funny in UKIP, so it's a bit problematic. However, what you also have here is Alex Salmond being presented as some kind of Nigel Farage, UKIP leader. Here we have Miliband and Cameron both being pulled by these two political forces, the SNP on the one hand and UKIP on the other. And that is correct. Scotland and the rest of the UK at the moment are facing an issue whereby there are two separate nationalist parties that are pulling in very different directions on different parts of the UK and on Labour and the Conservatives in very different ways. But I think that's the end of the similarity, because what do UKIP want? UKIP want Britain out of Europe. They want more privatisation of public services. They want an end to migration. What do the SNP want? Well, they want Scotland in the European Union. They want more migration into Scotland. They want more immigrants in Scotland. And they want an end to austerity. So there might be nationalist movements, but of very, very different kinds. So drawing a parallel there, I don't think is that valuable, but the impact that both parties are having is worthy of consideration, certainly. Here is the historic day itself. Here is my ballot paper. Now, how the hell did I manage to photograph that in the ballot box? I voted 3 weeks before the referendum. I had a postal vote. Yeah? As did 800,000 other people in Scotland. So I'd already voted way before the referendum. Should Scotland be an independent country? Well, I make no apologies for saying I'm very biased in this respect. I voted yes. And now I usually make the thing, I voted yes, but I'm not a nationalist. I'll come back to why I would vote yes and I'm not a nationalist a little bit later. So that is the ballot paper itself. So what were the issues? What were the issues? Now, I'm not going to run down every one of them. This comes from the Yes campaign, so I know it's biased, but the issues that they represent there are not that unobjective, I have to say. Here you have David Cameron representing no on one side, Alex Salmond voting yes, or representing yes, I should say, on the other side. I just want you to look down those issues. Free prescriptions, no tuition fees in Scotland for students, free personal care for the sick and elderly, working for a nuclear-free Scotland, don't want nuclear weapons in Scotland, renationalising the postal service, which was privatised by the UK government, Scottish future in Scotland's hands. Obviously they're saying Cameron works for his Tory pals, destroying the welfare state. So when you look at those issues though, where are the Braveheart issues? Where's the issue about national identity? Nobody's really arguing in Scotland, oh, we need independence because Scottishness is under threat. Nobody's really debating the future of Scottishness. Nobody's questioning that there is this country that's got a huge historical past called Scotland, and there are these strange people in the world called the Scots. That's not really up for any sort of argument or debate. So the campaign is not about nationalism in that sense. It's about other issues. Right? So the main issues were these issues. A democratic deficit. So here we have, again, from the Yes campaign, who do you want to decide the government of Scotland? The 5.2 million people live in Scotland, or the 14 plus million people live in London, in the southeast of England. So if you want Scotland's future in Scotland's hands, of course you have to vote independence. Don't be governed by London. Right? The famous slogan that we keep hearing all the time, that Scotland has more giant pandas than Conservative members of Parliament. I'm very biased, but that is factually correct. There are two giant pandas,
and one Conservative MP. Well, I was never that good at sums of statistics, but I think that's double the number of pandas than there are Conservative MPs. So that might be a very biased, hugely biased poster. It makes the point. Why should we, although we is not a homogenous we, why should we have a government that we didn't vote for? How do you get a government you want? You have an independent Scotland. Yeah? What were the other issues? Currency and defence. Now, I think one of the main problems with the Yes campaign was it didn't really have its economic case well worked out in some respects. And I look back, I can critically reflect that Yes became this almost sloganistic term. How do you have a better society? You vote yes. How do we improve everybody's life? You vote yes. How do we transform the known universe? You vote yes. I want this jet. Well, you have to vote yes. I want a better meal tonight. You vote yes. I want cheaper alcohol. Vote yes. It was all that. Yes. It just became yes, yes, yes. And I understand the limitations of that now, looking back a little bit. The SNP wanted Scotland to keep the pound, be part of a currency union with the rest of the UK. The other UK party leader says no chance. I think if this had been 2008, before the crisis, or even back a couple of years before then, people said, you're going to have to get the euro. I don't think there would have been that much problem, because people are that used to now having the euro, get into shops and see things priced in pounds or euros. People go abroad, euros, it's great, why bother? But the euro crisis sort of knocked that out a little bit. What about a separate Scottish currency? You get a lot of jokes around that. Whiskey will become the currency. Fudge will become the currency. We'll be buying things in haggis, you know. It's all very funny, you know. Two haggis for a pint of beer, whatever it is, you know. Go and shoot another haggis, you can have something to eat, you know, whatever. So this was a real issue. Because at the end of the day, a lot of economic factors were big factors in the campaign. People were worried about, well, what currency are we going to be using? I get my pensions out of a UK-wide pension scheme. Will I still have that? So those factors were really, really important. And the SNP and Alexander in particular did struggle to answer those questions, no doubt about it. So what about the defence issues? Well, the Royal Navy nuclear submarine fleet is based less than 20 miles from where I live, on one of the lochs in the River Clyde, so I feel very protected by that. It's nice to see the nuclear submarines going up and down. It makes me feel more secure of an evening when I go to sleep. Yeah. But the vast majority of people in Scotland don't want nuclear weapons, and even more don't want nuclear weapons that are based in Scotland. And the argument has always been, if they're that safe, put them in the River Thames in London. Yeah, because the argument is there's nowhere really around English coasts where you could actually have the nuclear submarine fleet. And then the argument came up, the SNP said, well, we will have a Scottish military, we will be part of NATO. But many other people started saying, well, why? Why do you need any kind of military? Who's going to be the enemy? Who's going to invade Scotland? Now, I made these points in America last month at a lecture I was doing in Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and his hand went up at the back and said, Jerry, you said that Scotland doesn't need a military. I said, that's right. Well, nonsense in the world today, you must have a military. They will invade you. Who are they? Oh, they will invade you. And I think he's talking about Martians or, well, you know, aliens or, you know, whatever. Oh no, they will invade. I said, tell me, he's over the back, tell me, who are they? He said, oh, the Russians. I said, the Russians? Oh yeah, look what they've done in Ukraine. Ukraine today, he said, Scotland tomorrow. That's true, I couldn't make that up. I'm straight onto Facebook with that slogan, you know, as you do. Because if it doesn't go on Facebook, it didn't happen, right? So that's on Facebook, so that's proof that it happened, yeah? And somebody said to me, Jeff, you forget you're in the world where the Cold War is still taking place. So all you nasty Russians in here, keep your hands off Scotland, yes? But does Scotland really need a military? Why? The Republic of Ireland doesn't have much of a military, but nobody bothers about that. Who is the enemy of the Republic of Ireland? Who might that be? Who's the enemy of Scotland? So that's a big part of the debate as well. So, we get into the nitty-gritty of the referendum itself. We now have this famous front page of the Sunday Herald, 7th of September, which caused massive panic beyond Scotland. The whole of the known universe was panicked by this, yeah? There is one opinion poll which shows that the yes vote had hit 51%, 49% said no. Sunday Herald was the only yes
supporting newspaper anywhere in Scotland or anywhere in the UK for that matter. And up until this came out, the general view was the No campaign were well ahead. In opinion poll after opinion poll for the last year had them 20% ahead, in some cases 30% ahead, but they were well ahead. Now, people knew there was a slight converging, but not at this. Not like this. So when this came out, the days after, there was a massive onslaught on the yes vote side, the yes, massive attack. The BBC, many people thought the BBC was hugely biased against the independence campaign. There's been lots of accusations about that. Cameron, and we know this happened because it's come out, phoned the major UK banks, a lot of financial institutions, supermarkets and so on, and said, we need your support here. And they kept coming out and saying, if Scotland becomes independent, we're leaving Scotland. The Royal Bank of Scotland said, if we become independent, we're leaving Scotland. Most people were saying, cheerio, because the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland are hardly a byword for financial propriety. Yeah? So the idea of the banks leaving, people are not really tearful about that. Although, of course, people were concerned about it economically. Supermarkets come out and saying, Scotland becomes independent, the price of milk, the price of bread, the price of eggs will all be much higher than an independent Scotland. You'll not be able to survive. So the dominant message is very negative, very critical. Yeah? Last minute intervention by Gordon Brown, former Labour Prime Minister before Cameron, after Gordon Brown, Scottish MP in Fife, ex-Chancellor of Exchequer. And Gordon Brown and the Labour Party played a massive role in keeping Scotland within the UK. And it's partly reflected in this, the vow. Here is the Daily Record, the main tabloid newspaper in Scotland. Here we have it on Tuesday the 16th of September, 2 days before the independence referendum. And here we have, can you imagine the names that are called here, the Three Wise Monkeys and Three Amigos. Here we have David Cameron, leader of the Conservatives, Ed Miliband, leader of the Labour Party, Nick Clegg, leader of the Liberal Democrats. Basically saying, we make a vow to Scotland that if you vote no, Scotland will get extra powers. And to quote Gordon Brown, it will equate to almost home rule for Scotland. Now that one newspaper headline, very rushed, cobbled together at the last minute. This one newspaper headline is now creating a huge constitutional issue in the UK. So just look, it's not just a cartoon. This matters today, and I mean today. Massive implications. Within weeks of it, of course, other people were coming out saying, well, wait a minute. So much for the vow. It wasn't a vow, it was a lie. The question of Scotland is, what are you going to do about it? Because in the morning of the independence referendum results coming out, Friday the 19th of September, already appeared that the Prime Minister was beginning to retreat a wee bit on this promise of extra powers. Yeah? They set up the Smith Commission, which looks into new power, so that was guaranteed. They said by the end of November this year, by the 30th of November, i.e. yesterday, which is St Andrew's Day, back home, by St Andrew's Day, there'll be new powers on the table for Scotland. So everything is fine. No, it isn't. Right? So what comes out of this? Well, let me go back to the referendum. As we know, 55%, just over 55% voted no, just under 45% voted yes. And you look at the map here and you see this map of red voting no Scotland, apart from these strange places around about Glasgow and Dundee on the east coast. But the rest of Scotland is uniformly no voting. Well, it's not as simple as that. Yeah, it's actually much more geographically divided. Here is my hometown, the holy town of Paisley. You can see Paisley voted yes, you see the Paisley pattern in there. Glasgow, you can now get polo shirts and t-shirts and sweaters in Glasgow. The Republic of Glasgow, the yes voting Glasgow. So there's real differences in different parts of Scotland. Here we have the geography of the referendum. What it shows, very clearly, the more affluent the population
of an area, the more likely it was to vote no. And conversely, the poorer the population of an area, the more likely it was to vote yes. Every Holyrood constituency, there's 8 of them in Glasgow, voted yes. Every Holyrood constituency in Edinburgh, there's 5 of them, voted no. 2 cities 55 miles apart, very different outcomes for reasons I can go into later on. The problem for the Labour Party is that the yes voting areas have historically been the big Labour Party supporting areas. Now this has got consequences for the Labour Party, not only in Scotland, but on a UK level as a whole. Here we have the most deprived areas in Scotland from the 2011 census. What this tells you is the areas that contain the proportion of the greatest deprived areas. Glasgow, Inverclyde is just down the coast from Glasgow. Dundee, Western Bartonshire, again just out from Glasgow. These are all west of Scotland areas. Yeah. And then I say, well, let's look at how that maps against the yes vote. So what does that show you? The areas of the poorest parts of Scotland, to the level they're slightly under the 50%, but those were areas that voted yes. So there's an absolute correlation between the economic vibrancy, health, issues of affluence and poverty of an area, and how the vote manifested itself. Yeah? By age and gender, well, again, there's different ways of measuring this. 16 and 17 year olds were given the vote. By a small margin, they voted no. Those in their 20s actually voted yes, much more. But as you go up the age band, to get to the over 65s, the majority of the over 65s voted no quite clearly, which has given rise to the claim, perhaps a bit unfriendly, that we just wait for them to die out and then we'll have an independent Scotland. It's hardly a good policy, though, wait till the old people die. In terms of gender division, well, you know, we find that 49% of men voted no, 58% of women voted no. So it's a bit of a gender divide, although it works in different ways across different parts of Scotland. And again, a lot of people say, well, women in particular were frightened about what will happen to the health service, what will happen to public sector employment, the supermarket costs, all these kind of things came into play as well. So what was it that swung the vote? What made the difference? Well, I do think the vow made the difference, or made a difference, a big difference. The No campaign, who themselves refer to their campaign as Project Fear, were successful in basically having people worried about what an independent Scotland would look like. It's going to be a bankrupt Cuba, somebody said. Yeah, it's not going to be able to meet all its goals. 20% of the population still have a strong attachment to a sense of Britishness, and new issues about religion also come into play. There are 800,000 English-born residents in Scotland. The vast majority of them voted, not surprisingly, no, but there were groups like English Scots for yes, who voted yes, obviously. But the key thing, as I said, is this promise of additional powers for Scotland. What about the SNP core vote? This is something a lot of people haven't picked up on. 14% of the 2011 Scottish electing SNP vote didn't turn out to vote yes. So think about that. In its own heartland areas, the SNP didn't get a yes vote. So when I look back, Western Isles, solidly SNP. The Northern Western Isles, Lewis and Harris and Bekele, all voted no. The Southern Isles, Southern Western Isles, Eriksay, Barra, South Uist, all voted yes. Does anybody know what the difference is between the North and the South of the Western Isles? The North is Presbyterian, South is Catholic. And religion has played a part in this. But Alex Salmond and the SNP, their heartland in Scotland is Aberdeen and Aberdeenshire. Aberdeen City, rural Aberdeenshire, Murray. They couldn't return a yes vote in their own heartland. Now, I'll come on to that in a minute or two. But what this tells us is that the SNP heartlands were struggling about the yes message. What were the issues? Well, in a lot of the heartlands, it's very rural, it's quite conservative with a small C, small farming communities, fishery communities and so on. But the SNP have increasingly moved to the left. They're campaigning against nuclear weapons, against privatisation, against austerity. Their message is much more aimed at the urban centres in west of Scotland. It's not aimed anymore at rural communities in north-east Scotland. So they have an issue here for the SNP. Fear of job losses in the oil industry in Aberdeen, big issue. Oil companies are threatening to relocate elsewhere in the UK. Big employment source, not just in Aberdeen City, but in Aberdeenshire as a whole. So there are reasons for this. But what it tells us is that Scotland is not a homogenous country of 5.2 million Scots who all love each other because they're Scots, but it's a very divided, fragmented, unequal and uneven society, depending on where you live and so on. What about the Yes campaign? Now, I've already said that when you look back at the issues, it's not a nationalist campaign. And the amount of people who said to me during the campaign, oh, you're just a nationalist. So I'm not a nationalist. Yes, you're just a nationalist. You're a Scottish nationalist. So I'm not a Scottish nationalist. The issues for me were about trying to create a fairer, more equal, more prosperous Scotland for everyone. I didn't want nuclear weapons in Scotland. Doesn't mean me a nationalist, yeah. One of the big issues was about opposition to welfare reform, cuts in public services. That galvanised a lot of people. The Yes campaign wasn't just the SNP. We have the Radical Independence campaign, Hope Over Fear, Women for Independence, National Collective as artists and poets and musicians touring the country, Scottish Greens, the Scottish Socialists, the Socialist Workers' Party, the Socialist Party and others. They were all part of this pan-yes campaign, not for nationalist reasons. But if I had a pound for everyone who called me a nationalist, who themselves is a British nationalist, I'd be able to retire tomorrow. Because often the people who are saying, you're just a nationalist, well, what do you represent? Well, I want Britain, I want Scotland to be part of Britain, it's a strong, prosperous Britain. Is that not nationalism? So there's an issue here that what kind of nationalism we're on about, yeah? What has happened to the Yes campaign since the 18th of September? Well, the SNP on the 18th of September had a membership of 25,500. Just over a week ago, the SNP's membership had hit 92,000. Their plan is to have 100,000 by Christmas. Now look at that on a UK basis. That would be a party with a membership of about a million people. So it doesn't seem that much to everybody else outside Scotland, but remember the size of Scotland. The Greens, the Scottish Socialists, all have seen a big increase in their membership. There's been talk about a campaign around the 45. The 45% who voted yes. But that notion of the 45 is a very important historical thing, because people will talk about the 1745 rebellion of the Jacobites in the Scottish Highlands. Yeah? So it's history, repeat itself, although it's obviously muddled up Braveheart history. Yeah? So the Yes movement is not going away anywhere soon. Definitely not going away. So what are the big problems ahead for the UK? So let's start with next year's rapidly approaching May 2015 general election. Now, interesting times. Because already people have said in Scotland, what we need to have is a pan-yes alliance. That we will not stand against each other. So there may be the SNP sitting in one seat, Socialists in another, the Greens somewhere else. But we'll not campaign against each other. And by that, we'll ensure there's a huge yes supporting majority. And the party that's in the target here, it's not the Conservatives, they've got one seat. It's the Labour Party they're coming from. Because a lot of people on the Yes side feel that Labour sold Scotland down the river. It's the Labour Party who appear to have problems. 37% of Labour voters deserted it. A lot of people have left the Labour Party. Some have joined the Labour Party. But it's the Labour Party who appear to be in crisis after the Scottish independence referendum. It's lost its leader and its deputy leader, the leader left saying, we're just like a branch office of London. Well, that's what SNP have been arguing for a long time. So they've got a real problem with their profile and their presence in Scotland. And it's basically a case that, you know, Labour maybe won the battle but lost the war. Because if you're in Scotland today and you look at what's going on, you would almost have thought that it was the Yes side that won. They appear to be victorious, whereas it's the No side that appear very downbeat and uncertain about where they're going. You would think that the Labour Party, being successful in keeping Scotland within the UK, would be celebrating. There's not much celebrating going on in the Labour Party at the moment. Now, why were Labour so keen to keep Scotland in the UK?
But one of the key factors here is that for Labour to form any UK government, it relies quite heavily on votes from Scotland. It's not entirely dependent on it, but it's got 40 MPs from Scotland. So if Scotland was independent, that's 40 seats that Labour has to win in England, more than it normally would have done to get a majority. So Labour needs Scotland. But in winning the referendum and securing those 40 seats on a UK basis, it looks like it will lose a lot of seats in Scotland now from people who have said, never again will they vote for the Labour Party. And that's not just the 37%, that's the Labour Party supporters, but other floating voters. So Labour have a big issue in Scotland at the moment. What are the other issues that have come out of it? Well, again, here is a huge issue.
Within hours of the referendum result coming out on the Friday morning, the 19th of September, Cameron got up on some platforms on the television saying, well, Scotland has spoken, it's now time for England to speak. Now, this is where things begin to get very interesting, begin to unravel. Because there's been a backlash in England. What about us? Scots have devolution. People in Northern Ireland have devolution. The Welsh have devolution. England has no devolution. There's no such thing as an English Parliament. And in England, I hear all this all the time. People look at Scotland and they think it's a land of milk and honey. No tuition fees for students. Free prescriptions. Free personal care for the sick and elderly. What about us? Why can't we have all that? It's because we are subsidising those Scots. What about laws for England? Why should Scottish MPs vote on issues that are English-only issues? Fair question, but that has major constitutional issues for the UK. So, what started to happen is that people have been demanding some degree of English devolution or English government. Now, think about it. England is 86% of the population of the UK. So, say we had an English government looking after 86% of the population. That's almost as powerful a government as a UK government would be. Massive issue there. Other people talk about have a federal structure. You can't have a federal structure if one country is 86% of the overall wealth and income and so on. It's hugely problematic. So the thing that's now began to come into the news all the time, you hear in the media, people talk about evil. Not EVIL, although some people could be the translator, is that English votes for English laws. It should only be English MPs who vote on English matters. Now, of course, this plays into the hands of who else? The SNP. Why? The SNP love it. Because for the first time since 1707, a country called England has been rediscovered. A group of people called the English have been rediscovered. And the more that England begins to act as England, and the more that England begins to look as if it's interested in the English, the more the bonds that secure the UK begin to tear and fragment and become diluted. So the rise of the English question plays well for Scotland if you are in the SNP or pro-independence. Now the SNP are basically saying that this promise of extra powers, we're going to guarantee that Scotland gets the promises made in that vow 2 days before the referendum. Remember what Gordon Brown said? These powers will amount to almost home rule, maximum powers for Scotland, as long as you stay within the UK. So the SNP are saying Scotland should have devolution max. I mentioned this earlier. The devolution of as many powers as possible to Scotland well, Scotland stays within the UK. Some people translate it as independence light or Devil Max. Yeah? And what they're arguing is that Devil Max is just one step on a longer historical process towards full independence for Scotland. Now we come to last week, the issue that's breaking now. Ali referred to this at the start. 19th of September, the Smith Commission under Lord Smith was established by Cameron to look on what extra powers could be given to Scotland. Yeah. This was the promise that was made that Scotland would have additional and major devolved powers, reported last Thursday. Some new powers in relation to income tax, some areas of welfare benefits, employment policy and so on. They're very limited, very limited. The last minute changes were made to the plans, the devolution of welfare powers was removed, further tax devolving powers was also taken out, and this has been attacked by the SNP for not going far enough, and attacked by the Labour Party Conservatives in England for going too far. So once again, the main beneficiaries of this will be the SNP. Why? They can turn around and say, those promises that were made are now not being met. The only way Scotland can get what it deserves is by voting yes to Scottish independence. So this is beginning to play out in the media. Right? These are all taken for the last couple of days or so. Right? Here we have Conservative MPs in England. This is the Telegraph, the House newspaper of the Conservative Party, basically saying, ban Scottish MPs from becoming Chancellor, Tory MPs demand. They've also said that Scottish MPs should be banned from voting in any English matter. Here we have Miliband of the Labour Party basically saying he has given powers to Scotland, but the Labour Party in England thinks he's given too many powers to Scotland. Because people in Scotland maybe think something different. So Labour and the Conservatives have got issues here. Here's the Smith Commission, here's the Independent from a couple of days ago. Scottish welfare controls are watered down and removed at the 11th hour. So it looked like we're going to get more devolution around welfare issues. It's taken out. The Herald, just a couple of days ago, Smith Commission is not a satisfactory or stable arrangement for Scotland. It's not a stable arrangement for the UK either. So more trouble ahead. Here's the Sunday Herald from yesterday, to think when that was. Yesterday, the powers unionists scrapped. Powerful headline. So yes, support and independent support paper, but nonetheless, powerful. And there's the Guardian, or the Observer, it's the Sunday Guardian. There's Kevin McKenna, Glasgow-based journalist for the Guardian, speaking yesterday. David Cameron has sold Scotland down the river. The Smith Reports confirms little, other than the Tory leader is undoubtedly the politician of the year. Now, you cannot make this out, but I'm going to just read this. In the Scottish Higher Modern Studies exam, this is 6 years Scottish year exam, the paper for the class of 2025 should say, I would not be surprised to read the following question. To what extent do you think that the Smith Commission of 2014 played a key role in bringing forward the second referendum on Scottish independence? Because this is what people start to say. It's inevitable now there will be another independence referendum. Now, what additional powers do Scottish people actually want? Well, I'm not going to go through all of this, but just look at the figures. Control of all taxation raised in Scotland. All taxation. Not just income tax. Wealth tax, corporation tax, value added tax. All taxes. A very small 71%. Control of all areas of government policy except for defence and foreign affairs. 66%. Control of the welfare and benefit system. A very small 75%. Control of policy regarding state pensions, 65%. Control of oil and gas revenues from the North Sea, 68% want that. Broadcasting policy, well, why does it matter? As long as I can see Doctor who cares, right? 54%. Those demands fall well short when you look at the results of the Smith Commission. It has not met any of those at all. Now, we can assume these are not all yes voters. Because the evidence shows that the majority of people who voted no, understanding that Scotland was going to get more powers. There was going to be change. But it looks like the change is much more limited than many people had anticipated. So, we're reaching a deep constitutional crisis. I'm just about to finish. Here's Simon Heffer again in that very left-wing Trotskyist journal called The Daily Mail on the 22nd of November, okay, a few weeks ago. To complicate matters, it says Labour seems certain to face a savaging in Scotland. One poll has forecast it might hold just 5 of its current 41 seats because of the relentless march of the SNP. It is therefore quite possible the SNP could hold the balance of power in Westminster. And since it has ruled out any deal with the Tories, but indicated that it would help Labour, this would land us with a Miliband government that only a small minority in England would have voted for. And I'll put this bit in bold. The idea of a party that wants Scotland to leave the UK, showing up the government of the UK, is an insult to democracy. It would be even more outrageous if a Labour-run government relied on SNP votes to push through measures that affected only England. Yet if, in turn, the SNP refused to support a Miliband government on measures that only affected English voters, the result will be constitutional and governmental paralysis, with Parliament unable to pass laws on health, education, transport and so on. In sum, we would have an administration that was unable properly to govern 85% of the population. So it appears now the democratic deficit is a democratic deficit for England. But look at the constitutional outcome here. You could actually have a Labour Party in government, but not in power. Right? Because it's relying on votes from Scotland. So, goodbye to the UK. Well, one can only hope that it will be goodbye to the UK. I know that's got implications for GBZ, but we've already got an alternative title, as people know. Huge implications. One irony, I think, of the Scottish independence referendum is it's ended up being a debate about Englishness and policies for England. How do we have English devolution? Yeah. Main UK parties, they're falling out over this because it plays in different ways for the different UK parties. The rise of UKIP, and I think UKIP are an English nationalist party, or they might call themselves, but they are an English nationalist party. So the future of the UK, I think, is further constitutional unravelling. And therefore, I think that Scotland will inevitably become independent. But I think this is largely now because of issues happening outside Scotland as it is a result of issues that are happening within Scotland. So the independence referendum has settled absolutely nothing. This was the promise. It was going to settle for once in a generation the constitutional future of Scotland and the UK. It has settled absolutely nothing. Scottish voting intentions next year, you have the SNP there at the bottom. Now, if that is translated in May next year, it's an SNP whiteout. Total SNP victory. What about a never-ending story, as some people have called it? Well, there you go. Support for another Scottish independence referendum. 66% say we should have another one in 10 years. 53% should say we should have another in 5 years if the Conservatives win next year and don't have any or very few MPs in Scotland. 55% of Scots support another independence referendum if the UK votes in 2017 to leave the EU. Because the expectation is the majority of people in Scotland will vote to stay in the EU. So 2015, 2017 are huge trigger events that are going to bring forth all these questions once again. So as I said, independence of Scotland is now inevitable. I think it's inevitable. But as much for reasons of things taking place in England and elsewhere in the UK as it is for issues in Scotland alone. So, is this the final unravelling of the most powerful, largest empire the world has ever seen? One can only hope it is. Now, let me come back to the images at the start. Here's, I just thought to pull us up for a bit of history. 1919, George Square in Glasgow, there's the red flag was flying. Tanks on the streets. Yeah. Fear of a Bolshevik uprising in Glasgow, 1919. Here we have the image that you saw at the beginning, isn't it? Yeah, remember the image I said hold on to? There it is, yes? No, it isn't, because this was taken on October the 12th. This is a few weeks after the referendum. It looks exactly the same as the image that was taking place the night before the referendum. Yeah? People are now referring to George Square as Freedom Square, Independence Square. I mean, we get a bit carried away with these things, but that's what has become the language of a lot of people. Then we come to this. Here is the new Scottish National Daily Paper. Here is the first ever issue. Copy that I will leave here, because I bought two copies. Has been launched as a supporter of Scottish independence. Now, the fact that has launched just last Monday tells you one thing. There must be an appetite for something like this. Yeah, we'll see how long it lasts, but it's there, the National. Right? So that came out last Monday. Here we have two events. Top event is the SNP conference. 12,000 people there. Bottom one is the Radical Independence Conference in Glasgow. 4,000 people at that. And these two events took place within 600 yards of each other. Two big halls on the banks of the River Clyde. When did that take place? 22nd of November. So you look at that image, the national paper, you look back at the images just before, the Yes campaign has not gone away. The demand for Scottish independence has not gone away. And I'll put up my final and favourite slide. One can only hope. So thank you for listening. Yeah? Time for debate and argument. So, right, now you can throw tomatoes and say I'm very biased, and it's terrible how biased I was, but I am biased. So, questions, yeah.
What do you think that made this referendum possible in the 14 years? What was the main incident or incidents that brought?
When you say the 14 years, you mean the 40 years since I was here?
Yes, because you said it wasn't possible.
Well, I think devolution has made a difference, for a start. Yeah, I mean, devolution was introduced as... You may forget that the Labour Party introduced devolution to stop the rise of Scottish nationalism. And the SNP supported devolution as a first stage of the step towards Scottish independence. So we've become used to a Scotland where there's more control over our bread and butter issues from the Scottish Government in Edinburgh. So the introduction of no tuition fees, all these kind of things have played very, very well. And it adds to this idea of Scotland as a very distinctive place, very different place. But the other change that's happened is that in 2010 we had the UK general election. Conservatives came back in. So for the first time in 11 years of devolution, you had a Conservative government. And that was a Conservative government committed to austerity, cutbacks in public expenditure, privatisation of the National Health Service and so on. But that was largely in England. But what people in Scotland are saying is, we don't want that in Scotland. We want a big state in Scotland, we want big public expenditure. The SNP said the only way you can protect these things in Scotland is by voting yes. So I think it was largely to do with political changes at a UK level, a deepening sense of Scottishness, a deepening sense that we have a UK government that's alien to Scotland. People talk about the 1980s when the Conservatives won four consecutive general elections. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher was absolutely hated in parts of Scotland. I mean, what was it, last year she died? There were street parties in Scotland about that. People were celebrating that, yeah? It's the same in parts of England, the old mining areas. So there was a lot of history coming back. Now, let's not say everybody in Scotland thinks the same way, they don't. But there's a very strong opposition to what appears to be happening in England around public services and so on. And as I say, it's not about nationalism. Nobody's really saying, oh, it's national liberation. It's about protecting public services and trying to create a more equal and prosperous Scotland. People don't think that can happen on a UK-wide basis anymore. So, I think those are the main factors. There's others, but those are the main ones I would focus on. Yeah. Where are they back?
Me?
No, sorry. You'll be next.
Could you say a little bit more about those who were entitled to vote in the referendum? That's an interesting point, and especially if you're living in Germany and a federal country that is very pro-EU. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, every EU citizen under the age of 16 registered living in Scotland is entitled to vote. Mm-hmm. But Scots outside Scotland, whether they were in the UK or Canada mm-hmm. or indeed in Berlin,
yes,
for that matter, were not entitled
to vote. Right.
Could you say what difference that would have made? It may have been very impractical to have all those voting, but could you share with us what you think what difference that might have made to the outcome?
Interesting.
Can I ask a more slightly more philosophical question, mm-hmm. which is, can you tell us a little bit more about how you see the advantages of full independence over self-government?
Okay.
My point about that is, my own view is that the nation state is having a pretty rough time at the mm-hmm. moment, actually, and the idea of independence is very much a sort of 19th century concept,
of course.
Where I think it's been rather sort of overtaken by events.
Yes. So
two questions.
And philosophically, I would agree with the second one as well, but I'll come back to two. Yes, when it was announced that, as you say, EU citizens over the age 16 who were living and registered in Scotland could vote, there was very little opposition to that. Nobody was, and this is where I think, often find myself in a position I thought I'd never be in, is defending the SNP, because they're not an ethnic nationalist party. Any one of you who can come to Scotland, live in Scotland, be as Scottish as anyone else, and have entitlement to be a Scottish citizen. So that's fine, very positive. I think for people outside Scotland, fix a lot of this up in England and also in the United States. People say, oh, that's terrible, terrible. I wasn't allowed to vote. Well, when were you last in Scotland? Like 15 years ago. Well, what are you doing in Scotland today? I'm not really contributing in any way. Yeah, but I'm still Scottish. I said, what does that mean? It's not an ethnic thing. It's about how much you contributed to be part of the society. The evidence tends to suggest, it's very anecdotal, that the majority of people from other parts of the world who claim to be Scottish would have voted no. Right? Now, I don't know if it would have necessarily swung it even higher towards a no vote, but I think it would have had a material effect in that respect. Not every single one of them, but there was a few. Scotland goes independent, how do I get back home, all that kind of stuff came into play. On the issue about independence as opposed to self-government, you're absolutely right. It's a 19th century, even you want to go further back, notion of the importance of the nation-state. Though in saying that, we live in a world where there appears to be more and more groups of people fighting for some sort of national status, some sort of national recognition. I don't think it's independence in the way that you've philosophically described it. It's constitutional independence. But the idea that Scotland, in the EU, or in this globalised world, is going to have any more control of its future destiny, I think is hugely problematic. And that's why there's a lot of people have an argument with the SNP. For the SNP, independence was a means to an end. It was an end in itself. For all the other groups in the Yes movement, independence was a means to an end. Yeah, it was to create a different kind of Scotland. The debate is, can you create this socialism in one country, or whatever, social democracy in one country? But nonetheless, the national expression of that has become quite important. And I think the challenge is, because I'm not a nationalist, is to create some kind of momentum in Scotland that isn't nationalist, that recognises that somewhere called Scotland. And it's very easy to slip into a sort of nationalist rhetoric that everything about Scotland's wonderful. I don't believe that for a minute. So although it's a 19th century notion, I think it's still got political relevance today. I mean, Britishness is a national entity, and it's still got 19th and even further back implications. Yeah. So philosophically, I absolutely accept that point. So you were going to come in there? Yeah.
I would like to make a remark concerning Mrs. Thatcher. It came up when the British economy was very, very deep down, and British economic situation had lots of problems. Mm-hmm. There were strikes all over all the time, and she was the one who tried to settle this and brought back a British economy. And she is hated why? Because she didn't allow strikes anymore on all this. I mean, I'm not a conservative person, but I think you should see this all right. And as the Scottish people, when David Cameron now would have said, okay, we keep all our promises, which we gave them before this election day, then perhaps they would have fallen perhaps to the feet of David Cameron and have said, okay, fine with us. I don't understand all this.
I follow the first thing about Mrs. Thatcher. Obviously, I inhabit a different universe from you in that sense. But she did come in and say there should be no more strikes, we should close down unprofitable industries and all the rest of it.
The problem was, under Mrs. Thatcher, it's not the whole country who paid for that. The huge inequalities that Thatcherism represented is that some people paid the price for that prosperity. That prosperity was not equally shared across the UK by any means. Huge tracts of Scotland, industry was closed down, same in the north of England, and it's no surprise that the areas in England where Labour still have a strong basis are areas that were hard hit under the years of Thatcherism. So yes, she came in with all these promises, but the people who benefited were those at the top end of British society. It wasn't those at the bottom, right? So the issue of inequality, I think, is really crucial there. She was perceived as being anti-Scottish as well, rightly or wrongly, but that was a strong perception. The second question is, people, if David Cameron had come in and said all these promises won't be met, yes, the majority of people would have probably accepted that quite happily. Because prior to the independence referendum, the evidence showed that the preferred position of the majority of people in Scotland was to have devolution max. Full control over everything we can have, full control over, though we stay within the UK. But that's not what's happening today. We've been promised extra powers, but they're nowhere near this devolution max. So that's why it's not going to go away as an issue. Anyone else? Hi.
For me, your talk today has resembled rather a party political broadcast from the Scots Nationalists, without any deference to the other point of view. I only hope that perhaps the Gross Britannian Central invites someone here to give the other point of view, because yours has been singularly one-sided. I was glad that you stayed in the UK, because I think an awful lot of people also in England think. Together we stand, united we stand, together we fall. I'll get that right in a minute. United we stand, apart fall. Although the trend might be elsewhere for countries to look for independence now, I think actually you should be spending your time looking for ways to improve it within the Union and getting what you want, rather than produce what you have today, which is just a totally destructive view from a Scottish point of view.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because one, I'm not a member of the Scottish Nationalist Party, and I'm not a nationalist at
any Scottish nationalist.
I am not a Scottish nationalist in any shape or form. Never will be a Scottish nationalist, would never vote for the SNP. Yeah? But you like this term we, I mean, I'm not sure I have the same notion of we that you have, because the UK to me is a very different place from your understanding of what the UK is from the understanding of the majority of people in Scotland. I did say there were weaknesses with the Yes campaign. I said the whole economic basis had to be reevaluated, so it's hardly been unbiased. In that sense, I think there were big weaknesses. I did not vote for independence because I had any illusion of it some mythical Scottish way into the future, because I think Scotland is a hugely divided society. But it's the right of Scottish people to support national independence if that's what they want. If people in England said we want national independence, that's the right of people in England. I have no problem with that. I think the UK, though, as an entity, its days have gone, because the perception for a lot of people in Scotland and other parts of England as well is that the UK only matters now to those who are wealthy and powerful. It's not doing anything to any ordinary person in urban areas or rural areas in various parts of England, Wales, in Northern Ireland, never mind Northern Ireland, England, Wales and Scotland. So we have different views on this. We have certainly different views on this, but I don't think you can deny that people in Scotland have a right to vote for independence if that's what they want. You can say, well, I disagree with that. That's fair enough. But it's their right, isn't it?
Yes, of course it's their right. You've come across as a sort of wounded animal because of the loss of the poll, and spent an awful lot of time counting numbers in assemblies in Scotland now who want to do this, that, and the other. I think you should be spending more time trying to look constructively about keeping it together.
Keeping what together in the UK? Well, I don't think the future of the UK is going to be good for the majority of people in Scotland, nor for the majority of people in England. The amount of people in England have said to me if I had to vote, they'd have voted yes.
is quite significant. So again, but as a wounded animal, yes, I was a very wounded animal on Friday the 19th and 20th of September. I was really depressed. I didn't want to go out the house. Tell you how bad I was. I didn't go on Facebook or Twitter for 2 days. So there's a sure sign. I don't feel a wounded animal now. I feel there's still an opportunity to create a very different kind of Scottish society. But it's not Scottish in a nationalist sense. It's a society where it's a fairer, more equal, more prosperous society for everyone. And the UK, by any imagination, is becoming a less equal and a much more divided society. So apart from saying we can stick together, I don't have any notion of the UK as a homogenous we at all. Yeah, not at all. So I think you and I will have to disagree on those issues. Sorry, yourself at the very back.
First of all, your argument that people in Scotland are not governed by people they voted for, I think that's the problem in most countries. Especially, for example, in Germany, I don't know if you know about it, but the Germans are governed by a party from Bavaria, which most of them are not even allowed to vote for, because the party don't run in the other 15 countries. So I just wanted to say that. So you have not highly dense populated areas where people are governed by governments mostly voted for by the great cities, let's say. Yeah. Second, you said that the problem is that SNP is pro-EU, but it's against austerity policies. Mm-hmm. And as we see it today, in many European countries, Greece and so on,
yes.
Austerity policy is made because of the wishes of the EU. It's, let's say, it's quite appropriated. So how do you think that an independent Scotland in the EU will be different from that?
Okay.
And the third point, the areas in Glasgow where there was a very high yes vote, normally are areas where very much people do not vote at all.
That's right.
So they now voted because they wanted to have to make one different vote, and the next, if the yes vote would have succeeded. So by the next vote in a Scottish National Party governed Scotland, maybe, do you think those people would care again or stay at home again?
Okay.
Just for that. And the fourth point, is there anything, is there any, just short question, anything that Cameron could do that to bring you to vote no in the next referendum? Thank you.
Anything David Cameron could do to bring to vote?
No,
apart from resign. No, I'm not sure offhand what that would be. But let me start. The issue about, Bavaria. One of the first things I learned when I came to Berlin, first of all, many years ago, was not to say I loved Bavaria, because it was a strange world of strange people who sing funny songs. Am I right, Karina? Because you were the one who educated me on this, you know. I used to talk about, you know, Munich, it's far superior to Berlin, smack, you know. So now, you're going to disagree with me on this, but do the Bavarians see themselves as Bavarians first and foremost and Germans second? Or do they see themselves part of Germany? Because in Scotland, the majority of people see themselves as Scottish first and foremost. So even though you're absolutely right, people in different parts of the world do not get the government that they vote for, people in Scotland are not looking at that on a UK-wide level. They're measuring that in terms of what Scotland voted and how Scotland appears to be being treated. And the perception is, and I don't think this is entirely true, I have to say, is that UK government policies are perceived in Scotland to be against the wishes of the majority of people in Scotland. Yeah? It doesn't fit with Scottish sentiment. Not everybody in Scotland has the same sentiment. But that's the perception. It's a very powerful statement. Because the myth in Scotland is we're more collectivist, we're more egalitarian, we're more left-wing. In certain areas of policy making, that might be the case. But not everybody in Scotland thinks the same way. But that is a very politically powerful idea. And the second question you asked was about the SNP. If they were in the EU, they would still have austerity. Absolutely. That's why I don't support the SNP. Yeah, I'm not a Scottish nationalist, whatever people might think. I do not support the SNP, because the idea that all you need is an independent Scotland out of the UK, but in Europe, continuing with the same policies, you might dress them up in different ways, and everything else is going to be brilliant. I don't believe that for a second. No. For the majority of people who I think voted yes, it was about the possibility of creating a different kind of Scotland. The SNP's vision, and this is a lecture for another day, it's an extremely limited vision of what that might be. And in terms of what one thing could David Cameron do, It's not about David Cameron. I mean, I've no personal antipathy to David Cameron. It's not about him. He represents a UK that appears to be a million miles removed from a lot of people in the UK at the moment, and certainly from a lot of people in Scotland. He doesn't get Scotland, he doesn't understand the differences, he comes up to Scotland. I mean, Alex Salmond, who I have to say I've got no great favour for either, Alex Salmond said the best campaigner for the Yes vote was David Cameron. Because as soon as he came up to Scotland, he got things wrong. Because he just said what he would say, and then somebody said, no, you shouldn't have said it that way, because that is interpreted differently in Scotland. So I don't think it's about David Cameron, I think it's about the wider political structures of the UK. And there are big issues for England. Why should people in England be subject to policies that are in England only, and people in Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland can vote on that? I understand that. That is the reality of the UK. This is a historic mess we've come to. Rightly or wrongly, that's where we're at. And no one policy is going to remove that in the near future. Yeah. Anyone else? Hi.
I have a question, because I read somewhere, I can't remember, that the Nordic Council was thinking about inviting Scotland in case into the Nordic Council, in case Scotland became independent. Did that play any role whatsoever in the Yes campaign, or was that something?
Not explicitly, though the vision that the SNP had put forward, and not just the SNP, some of the other Yes supporting groups, was that there's nothing to stop us being a Scandinavian country, other than the fact that we're in the UK. Yeah? So lots of people would say, well, Scotland can't afford to go its own way. How can you survive as an independent small country of 5.2 million people? People would look across the North Sea to Norway and think, well, Norway's got a slightly lower population than Scotland. It's got large oil reserves, as Scotland got. We could be like Norway. So the idea of a Nordic society was presented as something that we could be. I think it's a very romanticised notion of what Nordic society is. The idea that Sweden is this wonderful, you know, paradise that we should all aspire to, I think is also hugely problematic. So it didn't play an explicit part. When people weren't voting on the basis of, well, we need to be like a Nordic society, it didn't really mean anything. But as an argument as to what we could become, it was certainly floating around, absolutely. Yeah. So I saw somebody else's hand up there. Hello.
I think I'm travelling with dismay a little bit. I believe that you, Scotland, has an ultimate responsibility before the whole Europe. Because if you're independent and you file your application to enter the EU, you would set a precedent for everyone to, you know, to just go rampant. That would have very serious ramifications for Spain, for Portugal, for France. Basically, you say that any community who feels, you know, not just independent, oh, we are different, can go apart from the country, break the historical, the cultural ties, and be independent, a new entity. That is, you know, we all come from the countries where, you know, there are different nationalities, ethnicities, etc., etc. But we all try to live together. And your breaking down the country is something I can't understand, to be honest. And why?
What country are we talking about?
The UK.
Ah, but what if you live in another country in the UK and you think of that other country as being the country you belong to more than you do the UK?
Well, that's a nationalism, isn't it? Well, it is.
The UK is not nationalist. See, this is it. Is the UK not a nationalist entity? There's something in the world called
nationalism.
Right. See, this is it. I had this student in independence campaign, Jay, you're a nationalist. No, I'm not. And the people who said that to me were British nationalists. I don't mean British nationalism in terms of the BNP or some right wing. But the number of people said, oh, I'm not voting for you, you're a nationalist. What? Oh, I want a strong United Kingdom. We should be better together as a UK, a powerful UK in the world. Sorry, that's British nationalism. Right? Now, again, I'm not defending the SNP, but if I was forced to pick between British nationalism or Scottish nationalism, I would, without a question, go for Scottish nationalism. Because it's not about invading other countries in the world. It's not about some imperial project that's years went, 100 years ago and more. That's not part of what I personally want in the world. In terms of EU membership, I don't want to be part of the EU, but not for other political reasons. Because for me, and this is where left-wing Jerry comes in, I don't want to be part of a capitalist United States of Europe, where European, you know, policies impact on a place like Scotland. If Scotland becomes independent, people vote to become part of the EU, the EU lets Scotland in, fair enough, but I'm not saying that I advocate that. Because it goes back to the question that was asked at the back. If Scotland's in the EU in its current setup, I don't think it would make much difference to the kind of Scotland I want to see, or the kind of Europe I want to see. It's not just about Scotland. But you come back to the issue about history and all the rest of it. I said that earlier on, Scotland has been an independent country for far longer than it's been a member of the United Kingdom. So what history are we talking about? Some people will go so far back, but you need to go even further back.
Can I just retaliate?
Of course you can. Retaliate, yes.
I think you're just feeding all the rope, isn't it? Basically, when you were a kid, I don't think that the question of Scottish independence was in the air. It's just digging up the hole by a teaspoon. You give more powers, and suddenly people want more independence. I'm not advocating...
And what's wrong with that?
Isn't the centralised statement...
Oh.
And the central state that provides powers a little bit.
But of course, that was the argument that was put forward by the Labour Party, yeah? How would Scotland have this, you know, wonderful welfare state, transformational childcare? How would it have a generous welfare system? You need the cross-distributional resources of a UK-wide basis. So the Labour Party were very strong about this, the party of the post-war welfare state. If you want to have that kind of welfare state, you need to stay within the UK. So I understand that argument. Absolutely I do. And I think another reason why people over 65 voted no is they're the generation that were part of that post-war welfare state and understood it on a UK-wide basis. Although we forget, the UK welfare state was also part of a nation-building exercise, create this new, modern, post-war United Kingdom. The problem is, can we actually say that the UK welfare state exists in exactly the same way today as it did in the past? Because the last 3, 4, 5 UK governments have reformed that welfare state. They've hollowed it out, to use the term, bit by bit. And Alex Salmond and the SNP, again, on the defensive, I'm not their supporter, I'm not here to advocate them, they said by holding on to a vision of Scotland as being a non-privatised, generous, non-punitive welfare state, we will be much more in line with the post-war British welfare state. And it raises the issue. We talk about Scotland diverging. The country that has diverged from that era is not Scotland, it's England. The promise of no tuition fees, free education for all, lifelong learning, NHS, everyone who wants it. That was that post-war British vision. That looks like it's now gone. And what people in Scotland say is we want to hold on to that. How do we hold on to that? The SNP argument is the only way you can hold on to that is by voting for independence. But again, I'll say for me, voting for Scottish independence is not an end in itself for me. It creates the possibility of creating a different kind of society. Rightly or wrongly. Yeah. So,
I think we can wrap it up here.
All right. Well, thank you for listening and disagreeing and having an argument. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And on behalf of the Secretary, thank you for joining us and thank you for this insightful lecture and your reflections on what may last.
Yeah, they were my reflections. And I did say at the beginning I was biased, but I have no problem saying that. Yeah. I think it's impossible to be objective about these things. You know?
So, thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening, for your questions. So you can come down and hit me now, those of you who disagree, you know. Good discussion.